This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Here's something both Republicans and Democrats agree on. President Obama's campaigns for president were masterful, particularly in their use of data, both in the collection of data and the analyzing of that data to turn out the vote. What the Obama campaign data gurus learned in 2008 was refined, indeed mastered in 2012, and we have one of the people responsible for that with us this hour. Andrew Claster was Deputy Chief Analytics Officer for the President's reelection campaign. He helped assemble and lead a team of more than 50 analysts, statistical modelers, and engineers. They used something called predictive modeling, among other things, not only to predict who would vote for Barack Obama, but what needed to be done to make them vote for the president, and what they shouldn't do if they didn't want to turn people off. Andrew Claster had previously worked for Hillary Rodham Clinton and Tony Blair, among politicos, but also for some of the world's largest companies, and is now working on moving the lessons learned from the Obama reelection campaign into the private sector, and he joins us for the hour, thanks to UNC Charlotte. Good morning. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Nice to have you here. Let us start with a definition. What is predictive analysis?
So what we're doing is we try to take the data that's available to us from whatever source, our internal data, public data, et cetera, mm-hmm. and we try to use that to predict people's behavior. So who is likely to vote, who is unlikely to vote, and who is most likely to increase their probability of voting, for example, in response to a contact from us, whether that contact is a volunteer calling them up on the phone or knocking on their door or a piece of direct mail coming from the campaign or television ad.
And when did this, I guess the word is process, when did this process begin to emerge and be used?
It's been a long evolution. Until a decade or two ago, the way these things would be done was you would have field volunteers in the field collecting data on individual voters. You would use the publicly available information, for example, regarding people's past vote history, who had voted in previous elections, who hadn't, precinct level data on whether particular precincts tend to support Democrats, Republicans, et cetera, and demographic data. People of what demographic groups, among each demographic group, how many people are going to turn out, how many people are going to support each candidate. And then in the last decade or two, as there's been more availability of data, as the social science has advanced, as there has been there have been a large number of experiments conducted trying to figure out what works and what doesn't. And as the combination of computing power and data altogether has made it possible over the last few years to build individual level predictive models so that we can, instead of predicting what broad demographic groups are going to do or what's going to happen in certain geographic areas, we can go down to the household or even individual level to try and predict people's behavior.
Then Senator Obama made use of this in 2008. Then it was made use of it in for his reelection campaign in 2012, and I'm told it was like the same thing on steroids because the technology had improved and the amount of data had increased, etc. But the Republicans didn't use this, neither in 2008 with John McCain or again with Mitt Romney in 2012. It obviously worked so well in 2008. Why didn't they?
So there's a lot of investment that has to take place. One thing that was important for us was to have the decision made at the top from the leadership of the campaign that this was going to be a data-centric campaign. Our campaign manager in 2012, Jim Messina, when he launched the campaign, he did so with an online video in which one of the things he said we were going to do was we were going to measure everything on the campaign. We're going to collect data. We're going to analyze it. If something works, we're going to do more of it. And if something doesn't work, we're going to change it or stop doing it.
Now, I'm sorry, but this flies in the face of the way political campaigns had been historically conducted, and a lot of it was fly by the seat of the pants, gut reaction. This is how people vote because we know how that. This is how we what we know. So, is it difficult for political people? Because you're a data person, you get this. Is it difficult for political people to put all of their faith and trust and eggs in that basket?
Absolutely. And so we have to do validation over time. And so in every election in 2008, in the off-year elections in 2009, the midterm elections in 2010, we view every election as an opportunity to validate our approach. Mm-hmm. So we build a particular type of model, we make certain predictions, then we see what happens on election day, we demonstrate the value of this approach.
And in fact, and I forgot the name of the gentleman who had been doing this for the Democratic Party, he predicted losses several years out. And he was right. And being right about a win is one thing, but being right about a loss is really impressive. And that's what impressed them the most, right?
I think a lot of our credibility came from the 2010 cycle, when which we knew was going to be a tough year for Democrats, and our team accurately predicted the magnitude of that.
So are there people, given your success not only in the 2008, but the 2010 and the 2012 election, of not only helping the winner win, but to predict where losses were going to be? Has this been adopted now by the Republican Party?
They are making a lot of moves to do that. They are they're actively engaged in, one, trying to deconstruct and figure out what we did, and also trying to build their own capacity. My expectation is that they're going to significantly narrow the gap over the next 3 years.
When you were describing what it is that predictive analytics is, you were talking about how it helps you know who is likely to vote, who will vote, who would vote for the president, who would not be swayed by voting for the president, and if they were likely to vote for the president, how could you push them into the definite category? What mm-hmm. would you have to do or not do to them? Because there are things that you don't want to do because it might turn them off. What would you have to do to make this happen? Is all of this new? I mean, has this been used in business to make me buy soap?
Absolutely, yeah. There are a lot of firms out there, some that have been doing it for a while, and a lot more that are looking to do that going forward, who are looking to use people's past purchase behavior and whatever information is known about them, demographic, geographic data, et cetera, to predict who is more likely to purchase my product or who is more likely to take this particular action in response to an ad from us.
But how do you know that? How do you know, A, I'm likely to vote or likely not to vote, likely to vote for the president or not likely to vote for the president, likely to respond to you or not likely to? How do you know that?
Well, we can look at actual behavior. So, for example, all your past election history, which elections you voted in, is publicly available and has been for many years.
But you don't know who I voted for.
No, we don't know who you voted for. But so there are a couple ways to collect data on who you support. One is polling. We can call people up and ask them in the next election, who are you going to vote for? Mm-hmm. Or in the past election, who did you vote for?
Do they tell you the truth?
In general, yes.
Okay.
And we can also look at we can validate that using precinct level information. So we know for every precinct in the country, every political precinct or ward, how many people voted for each candidate. And so we can compare people's survey responses to the precinct data, for instance, as a measure of validation.
So much of this is done by the telephone, those telephone surveys that we get that we're barraged with prior. Is it becoming more difficult to get truthful responses because people are likely now, because they're savvy to this, game the system? And is it difficult to get people to answer the phone? I don't answer the phone if I don't recognize the caller. I just don't.
Yep, that is absolutely a challenge. Response rates have been falling for years, and a lot more folks are cell phone only.
Yeah.
So
And you can't call them?
We can call cell phones.
Oh, okay.
The restrictions are that one can't use those automated dialers for calling cell phones, which raises the cost because then you have to have live interviewers dialing those phones.
You made 11,000 calls a night, I'm told, at one point in the Obamacare.
That's right. We did at one point, yes.
That's a lot of calls. So how do you get past the roadblocks being put up by technology?
Sure. So so there's a certain population that can still be contacted on landlines, another group who needs to be contacted by cell phones, but there are other ways to reach out to people as well. We can track people's we can look at people's behavior in social media, for example. We can there are surveys conducted online. And so there are certain populations who may not respond to a landline survey who will respond on a cell phone or to an SMS or to an internet survey. And so we have to figure out how to pull all of that data together.
People will actually take part in a text poll. You can text them who you vote for and they'll text you back.
Yep, absolutely.
We all have short memories in America, so we just can't get over that. We have to go back to the presidential reelection campaign because it was not a shoo-in. The economy was terrible. And in fact, although he inherited this bad economy, the president, if I understand, it was the highest rate of unemployment of any president in the last 76 years. Many Democrats, many Republicans really believed he couldn't win again. The Mitt Romney campaign not only believed they had a shot, I understand they believed they have a shot, they had a shot right up to election night. They thought they had it in the bag. Did you know beforehand that he was going to win re-election? And how far in advance did you know? And how did you know?
So one person who I'm sure is familiar to many of your listeners is Nate Silver, who's right. The blogger at the New York Times. And he built a model. I believe his model started in the spring or early summer of 2012, showing the president's probability of winning re-election. We had a similar model. And, you know, we view the world probabilistically. And so for the previous 4 years, we had a model and I had an estimate of how likely the president was to win a re-election. Mm-hmm. At no point during the previous 4 years leading up to 2012 was my expectation of victory below 50%.
Wow.
Now, the thing about there were times when it was, you know, maybe 55%. And the thing about events with a 45% probability of happening is that they happen 45% of the time. Mm-hmm. So there was it was never in the bag for us. It was never I never viewed it viewed us as a shoo-in for okay. re-election.
All right.
However, I always thought it was more likely that we would win than that we would lose.
When did you know you would win?
We had a very strong sense. Our model was very tracked Nate Silver's very closely. Ours ended up being slightly more accurate mm-hmm. By a fraction of a percentage point than Nate Silver's model. But if you look at his model, the probability of the president's reelection went from around 50 or 60% when he introduced the model up to over 90% by election day. So by election day, my expectation, similar to his, was well over 90%.
And yet Mitt Romney thought, his campaign thought, even on election day, that he had won. At least that's what we were given, mm-hmm. To believe. How could that be possible? He was the numbers guy.
Mm-hmm.
How come his numbers were wrong?
There are a couple things. So they didn't make the investment that they could have and should have made in data and analysis.
Let me stop you, and we'll finish that answer on the other side of the break, because I realize we're coming up to one fast here. Andrew Claster is the Deputy Chief Analytics Officer for the re-election campaign for the president. We're coming right back. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Audi of Charlotte, presenting a selection of luxury vehicles committed to customer service and satisfaction. East Independence Boulevard, inside the 485 Beltway. Audi, truth in engineering. Information at audiofcharlotte.com. And UNC Charlotte's 38th Annual International Festival, Saturday, September 28th from 10 to 6 at the Student Activity Center. Music, crafts, and food from over 50 countries, as well as an international game zone. Well, in the last 100 years, it has been the American century, but prognosticators say the next 100 years will be the Chinese century, China swiftly becoming a leading economic power. But some analysts, Timothy Beardson among them, see staggering challenges ahead for China that will likely prevent them from reaching the number one position. He will join us tomorrow at 9 to tell us why.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, last week two Colorado state senators lost recall elections because of their support for tougher gun control laws. The future of gun control legislation nationwide.
Join us for the Diane Rehm Show this morning and every weekday morning from 10 to noon, right after Charlotte Talks, here on listener-funded public radio, we're 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today, Andrew Claster, Deputy Chief Analytics Officer for President Obama's 2012 re-election campaign. He's in town to be with the UNC Charlotte students today, and you can see him tomorrow. There are a couple of tickets still available for his speech at the Westin tomorrow morning at 8. Information about that on our website at wfae.org/Charlotte Talks. I asked you how, just before the break, and we didn't have the time to get an answer about how Mitt Romney's campaign did not know that they had lost on Election Day because they thought that they had won, and he was the numbers guy. He kept saying, I'm the numbers guy. How could his numbers be wrong?
Their model was wrong. They had they didn't have the right view of what the electorate was going to look like. They made an assumption that that turnout in terms of who turned out that the electorate was going to look a lot more like the 2010 electorate, which was not a very good electorate for Democrats, than the 2008 electorate. And they didn't test those assumptions properly. There was a lot of data available to them, public data.
But why? They're smart people on the Republican side of the aisle, very smart people, incredibly smart people. Why didn't they test their assumptions?
You know, the assumption was that that Mitt Romney was going to have the most advanced, the most technically advanced, the most data-centric campaign based on what he did in 2008 and how far ahead that was of what his primary opponents did, Republican primary opponents. But there turned out not to be anything there. They didn't invest the way that they could have and should have in digital media. They didn't invest the way they could have and should have in modeling, in analytics, in data collection.
Did you think that they were likely to have a much better set of data analytics than they turned out to have? And did that force you to step up your game?
We knew that they were going to be hard-pressed to match us, in part because we had 5 years of experience by 2012, mm-hmm. starting in 2007, and they hadn't done as much over the previous 5 years as we had. However, it wasn't clear until very late in the campaign what they were doing. We expected them to do more than any other Republican candidate in that race, mm-hmm. And they may have done more than anyone else might have done,
yeah.
but it was still far below the investment that we made.
Does this explain why Karl Rove had a kind of meltdown on Fox TV the night of the election when they called Ohio and he said it's impossible? Ohio could not have gone for the president because our numbers show it going for Romney. It's not possible. And they took a camera back into the room where they count, mm-hmm. where they figure all this out, and it's a nonpartisan room, and they explained it, and he still wouldn't believe it. Is that why? Because his model was wrong, and he believed his model.
Correct. He wasn't the only one. You know, all the Republican pundits, George Will, Michael Barone, Dick Morris, of course, all were looking at all had access to numbers that had been leaked by the Romney campaign and by Republican consultants, and they all believed that Romney was going to win. All of their forecasts showed Romney winning, and not by a small margin.
So does that put the lid on that kind of political prognostication or predictions in a campaign? Has that model now been kicked to the wayside because of the success of your model?
I think so. I think that every future campaign is going to invest more in data analytics and predictive modeling than any previous campaign.
How did you know in 2008 what to start looking for that led to the success of the president that year and built upon in 2012? How did you know what questions to ask, what information you needed to more accurately predict the outcome?
So we used in 2008, 2012, and in every election, we use a variety of data streams. We don't just look at polling, for example. We don't just look at our predictive models. We look at field data. We look at voter registration data. We look at public polls. We look at our internal polls. And what we're trying to do with all these different streams of information is build a picture of the electorate. And if we have – if two sources disagree, then that's an opportunity for us to look much more deeply, to compare and figure out why are we getting this response in this place and this other response in this data set, and try to resolve those differences, try to figure out what's driving them.
It's not just predicting. It's motivating. It's massaging. It's moving people to your camp.
Yep.
How do you do that?
Persuasion is very challenging. So we have to identify the right message, which we can do through things like polling and focus groups and modeling. And then we have to identify the right people to target that message to. You know, we get a lot of credit on the analytics side for the president's reelection. But the fact of the matter is there were 66 million people who voted for Barack Obama. That is the second largest number who have ever voted for a presidential candidate. The largest number was in 2008 when 69.5 million people voted for President Obama. We did that with 4 million donors. 4 million people wrote a check or pulled out their credit card and went online or mailed us a check to support President Obama. 2 million people, 2 million volunteers organized all across the country, knocked on doors and made calls 146 million times to turn out those 66 million voters for Barack Obama. So, you know, you're starting with this base of support, and you have to build that. So our improvements are really incremental. If the analytics folks can increase the number of volunteers by 5 or 10%, and we can increase the number of doors they knock and phone calls they make by 10%, 5 or 10%, and we can increase the effectiveness of those calls and knocks with our predictive modeling by 5 or 10%, those 5, 10% numbers all add up.
But they compound. But you also knew who not to knock, whose door not to knock on. Mm-hmm. I mean, because they were either – in your camp or likely to be in your camp, but they were also likely not to respond positively mm-hmm. to personal contact.
Right.
You knew that. How did you know that?
So we do a lot of testing. And so we contact folks. If someone is a supporter and they're likely to vote, mm-hmm. Then that person is a potential volunteer or donor. Mm-hmm. So they're going to get a different type of contact from us. If someone is a likely supporter but they're not registered to vote, then that person is a registration target for us. So we prioritize people based on the action we want them to take. We try and decide who are the people.
But I want to be clear about this. This is so unusual, at least to me, when I read how you did this. You had profiles essentially on every single person in the country. This was not mm-hmm. a campaign that was blanketed. Let's send out this message to the masses on television mm-hmm. or this message to the masses in a mail out. Mm-hmm. This was almost targeted right down to the individual with a different approach and a different specific message to each individual voter in the country.
Mm-hmm. Well, that
– holy cow.
That base, you know, a national voter file, that's something that the Republicans have as well. And that's something that lots of organizations, companies all across the country have, a national database of every consumer or every voter in the country. A lot of this information can be purchased commercially or is available publicly.
How are they collecting this information? If you're not collecting, if the Democratic Party or the Republican Party is not calling me every 4 years or every mm-hmm. 2 years and asking me questions about my preferences, who is making those calls? Who is gathering that information? Who is making it available to you? And if they make it available to you, is that same data set being made available to the other side?
So both sides have their own groups who are compiling this data, but there are also companies uh-huh. that are compiling this data. And so voter files are publicly available in every state. You can request from the State Board of Elections or the equivalent a file which lists every single registered voter in the state. It has which elections they voted in. In states with party registration, which is more than 30 out of the 50 states, it tells you whether someone is registered to vote as a Democrat or Republican.
And if they're independent, it tells you what primary they voted in?
In many states, yes. So it provides the date they registered to vote. In most states, it provides their date of birth or at least their year of birth, their gender. In some states, it includes their ethnicity. So so there is a huge amount of publicly available data out there. And then these firms who acquire this data append to that things like what magazine subscriptions people have and what products they've purchased.
And how do you know that?
They get that from things like warranty cards that people return. They get that – they purchase it directly from companies that sell those subscriptions.
This is big data we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
You have said that in this last election, having a candidate with a record of policy positions that are consistent with the majority of the electorate and building a national organization of supporters and volunteers that will not only vote in your favor but will also influence others was what combined with big data to win the election. If the president is more in line with the majority of the electorate, how is it that we have such gridlock between the White House and Congress? I'm old enough to remember Lyndon Johnson, and although he had a Democratic Congress to deal with, he pushed through some very tough things, the Civil Rights Act among them, which he knew, and Democrats in Congress knew, would cause them to lose the South for the next 100 years.
Mm-hmm.
And that turned out to be correct.
Mm-hmm.
And yet he was able to get it through Congress.
Mm-hmm.
The president has had great difficulty getting things through Congress in both elections. And you say in the first one he won it with 69.5 million votes. That's a pretty heavy majority, the most of any president ever.
Mm-hmm.
Why do we have this thing where he can't get cooperation?
One thing is that the Congress that the American people voted for is not the Congress that we have right now. There were more people who voted for the Democrat to represent them for U.S. House than for Republican. But because of the way districts were drawn, because of gerrymandering, even though Democrats, votes for Democrat for House outnumbered votes for Republican for House by more than 1.5 million, we ended up with a Republican majority in the House. Because of the gerrymandering in the House. So,
but even when the president – in the first 2 years, he had a Democratic Congress.
Mm-hmm.
He still couldn't get things through.
Well, we got a lot of things through. We got our most important accomplishment of the first term was the president's health care, Obamacare plan. But there is a lot of gridlock. And part of that is that – on the Republican side, there is a division and there is a civil war going on between the extremely conservative, reactionary group that is trying to block anything that the president supports, and the folks who are trying to get things done. And that is a small. A small, weak minority within their party on Capitol Hill.
So it would seem to me that those of you who are involved in data gathering to help a candidate win, whether that candidate be one for president or one for Congress, Democrat or Republican, if you have this apparatus and this data processing model that can be used, can you use it to help whoever wins the presidency have a Congress that he can work with?
There are definitely ways that can be done. One of the things that we're engaged in now is in registering voters. For example, there's a project in Texas called Battleground Texas to try to change the electorate down there and get a lot of folks who have not traditionally registered to vote because Democratic candidates have not been competitive in the past, to get them involved in the process. The demographics in a lot of states like North Carolina, like Texas, like Georgia, like Arizona are changing in a way that is favorable for Democrats and in a way that moves a lot of states that were not traditionally competitive for Democrats into the battleground column. Mm. You know, when Barack Obama won North Carolina, Virginia, and Indiana in 2008, that was not only the first time in more than 20 years that a Democrat had won those states, it was the first time that a Democrat had even tried to compete in those states.
He won North Carolina in 2008 and lost it in 2012. Mm-hmm. Did that surprise you that he – either time did it surprise you?
So North Carolina was in 2008 the closest state for us. We won it by a fraction of a percentage point. And given, as you mentioned, the tough economy, we knew that the 2012 election was going to be a tougher election for us than 2008. And so the states that were toughest for us in 2008, which were Indiana and North Carolina, those were the tightest states that we won in 2008. We knew it was going to be an uphill battle for those in 2012. Right. And while North Carolina was a target for us, it was a lower tier target because in a competitive election, North Carolina was not a state that was likely to push us over the
Electoral College.
Exactly. Right. Was not likely to push us over the 50% plus one,
really,
which is 270.
It's really all about winning the Electoral College, isn't
it? That's right.
Which seems to be kind of unfair and undemocratic, but that's just the way the system is set up. Mark in Charlotte called but couldn't hold. He wanted to know, how long do you keep the information that you track, and is there a legal timeline for destroying data you collect? I would think the answer to that is no.
Correct. there is not. There is not. The data is available in North Carolina. I believe some of the data can even be downloaded online, but it depends state to state. But as I mentioned, in every state, you can go to the Secretary of State or the Board of Elections and request a voter file, which will give you the name of every registered voter in the state and their party registration, age, gender. And so, you know, that information is publicly available, and there's no requirement that one destroy it.
And Chris emails, can you ask your guest if they used microtrends as part of their data gathering? And also, who can forget unskewed polls?
Yeah, unskewed polls was great. That was to take the first question, microtrends. I believe she's referring to the book by my former boss, Mark Penn.
Yes.
And so I did some... I did a little bit of research for that book back in 2008. So micro-targeting is what this was called back in 2008. Now the fashion seems to be to call it analytics or predictive modeling. The idea is, whether you call it micro-targeting or predictive modeling, the idea is to get information at the individual level and target folks at the individual level.
Which is exactly what you did. Andrew Claster is our guest. He was the Deputy Chief Analytics Officer for the President Obama 2012 re-election campaign. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and NS2, presenting singer-songwriter John Prine in concert with guest Justin Townes Earle at Ovens Auditorium Saturday, December 7th. Tickets are available at Ticketmaster.com. And the UNC Center for Aortic Disease, providing comprehensive treatments for all aortic diseases. Information at uncaortic.org. The Washington Navy Yard shootings underscore ongoing concerns about gun violence. The debate over gun control legislation nationwide with guest host Steve Roberts coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on The Diane Rehm Show. Our guest today, Andrew Claster, is speaking at the Westin Hotel tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock. And you can get to our website at wfae.org/Charlotte Talks for more information on how to sign up for that. And you can go there to join our conversation as well. And we will continue in just a moment.
The time has come. Welcome to select one.
The bright lights of showbiz have been shining around Charlotte.
Representing District 12 in the 74th Annual Hunger Games.
WFAE's next public conversation will explore how the local film industry works and what it means for the region. We'll also discuss where it's going and whether state incentives for filmmakers are a good deal for taxpayers. Join us Thursday evening, September 19th at Discovery Place. RSVP at WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Andrew Claster is our guest here with us from UNC Charlotte. He's actually the Deputy Chief Analytics Officer for President Obama's 2012 re-election campaign. I'm curious about your background. How do you get to be the Deputy Chief Analytics Officer? What did you do to get there?
Well, I started out volunteering on campaigns when I was a teenager in high school and college. I worked in political polling for a little while. I studied politics and economics with a heavy emphasis on statistics and data. And then from political polling, it was a natural progression as this new field developed, this field of micro-targeting and analytics and big data. It was natural for me to move into that field as the field evolved.
One would presume, and I could be wrong about this, that that experts in data collection and analysis, people who do what you do, and the 49 other people who worked for the president in that area, wanted the president to win. They wanted Barack Obama to win. They were partisans, and the same is could be said on the other side,
absolutely,
of the aisle. But the whole idea of data collection and analysis is to get the truth.
Right.
So how do you keep partisan hopes and dreams out of the analysis? How do you prevent what you analyze from being too rosy a picture?
So I think for folks who come from a background of data and analytics, and I think this is something that would be familiar to any scientist who has an interest in the outcome, I think it's important for us to keep in mind that the best way we can serve the president is by providing accurate, unbiased information. And that keeps us grounded. So just as a climate scientist presumably does not want the Earth to warm, that doesn't prevent him or her from doing good science. Similarly, the fact that we want the president to win should help us to ensure that we're providing the best, most accurate, unbiased information that's grounded in the data and not in our hopes, dreams, or beliefs.
But you also worked, I said in the beginning, for Hillary Clinton. Did you work for her presidential campaign or did you work for her senatorial campaign? Both. So when you were working for her presidential campaign and she decided to withdraw because of the juggernaut that was Barack Obama in the 2008 election, how difficult was it for you to throw your allegiance to Barack Obama?
For me personally, you know, I was I always liked both candidates a lot. I think they're both fantastic candidates. I think Hillary Clinton has done a fantastic job as First Lady, as Senator, and as Secretary of State. And so for me, you know, supporting moving from the Clinton campaign to the Obama campaign was not personally difficult at all.
Is there any difference from a political from a statistical analyst's point of view, such as yourself, in working on a political campaign versus working for M&M's, Mars Candy, Procter & Gamble selling soap?
Absolutely. You know, many of the challenges are different. So with an election, for example, you have a defined end date. In the corporate space, you know, that's not the case. In U.S. politics, in a general election, you're dealing with a binary outcome. Either you vote for the Democrat or the Republican. For a lot of companies, that's not the case. People may purchase products from multiple firms, for example. So there are a lot of differences there, and also there's a difference in terms of availability of data and the types of outcomes you're trying to drive.
So the kinds of techniques that you use to elect and re-elect the president, are those techniques being adopted by private company. I know that there's this, a group of your colleagues from the 2012 campaign who have started a company called AMG, Analytics Media Group, which is pitching their approach to various businesses. Are you part of this group?
I'm not. There are several groups, actually. The folks on my team many of them have landed at a couple different firms. One is called Civis Analytics, and the other is called Blue Labs. But there are... and then several of my colleagues have wound up at other organizations as well, and they're looking to do this work not just for political campaigns, but also for corporations. And here in Charlotte, for example, you have the Analytics and Big Data Society. You have the folks over at UNC Charlotte. And so there's a lot of interest in the academic sector, in the private sector, in big data and analytics and how to use that for companies and for social marketing
causes. How much of what you did and how you did it was developed while you and your others who worked with you were being paid by the Democratic National Committee, and how much of that remains the property of the method? How much of the method remains the property of the Democratic National Committee? Is it proprietary, or can you take it with you and give it to General Motors if they want to do a car campaign that way?
Sure. So all the data and tools belong to the successor to the Obama team and the Democratic National Committee. But the learning and the knowledge that my colleagues and I have developed is now being deployed on behalf of corporations.
Should corporations be doing their data analysis this way? Would it be helpful? Because it's not a Mitt Romney versus it's not Dove versus Safeguard. It's not Tide versus whatever other detergent is out there. It's a bunch of other products that do the same thing, and some of them are made by the same company. It's more difficult, as you point out. But should they all be using these systems?
I think there are a lot of companies that can benefit and are benefiting right now from doing that kind of analysis. And many companies are still trying to figure out what they can do in this space, how it can help them.
Because it is more than deciding who might buy some kind of cereal versus another kind of cereal. It's how to talk to them and talk them into buying.
Correct.
It seems monstrously expensive to do this. Not only the research, but then once the research points out that if you want to reach me, you have to reach me through couponing. If you want to reach somebody across the room, you have to reach them through a TV commercial. If you want to reach somebody listening to us on the radio, you got to listen to them. You got to get them on the radio. It seems monstrously expensive, is it?
In the context of a multi-million-dollar advertising buy, if you can improve the efficiency of your marketing efforts, whether it's TV ads or direct mail or online ads, it is an investment well worth making. Just as it was on the presidential campaign. You know, we were a $1 billion campaign, and analytics was a small fraction of that.
But you're only running against one other entity, at least once the primaries are over. I think of a product that they're running against hundreds of other entities.
Yep, absolutely. And so what that means is that you have to build different kinds of models. You know, the models we were building were trying to predict a binary outcome in many cases. Is someone going to vote yes or no? Is someone going to support the president yes or no? In the corporate space, you have to build different kinds of models because you're trying to predict a different kind of outcome. But the approach is the same.
Now, we know that the marketing used and the messages used to sell soap and cars and other things do not always necessarily tell the truth. What they say is things to light up our brains and make us excited and make us go out and buy the product. That's not a good or bad thing. It's just how it works. But with a political campaign where you're making statements about what you're planning to do or what you want to do and what you actually will do if you are elected or at least try to do, then you've got to find a message that resonates with people, and you say it differently to individual people. Where does the truth fall in all of that?
Well, any message that our campaign is going to deliver is going to be an accurate reflection of our candidate's priorities and what he or she wants to do. So it's we would never test a message that wasn't accurate, that wasn't true.
Really?
Mm-hmm. That's right.
If you've got 66 million voters who are likely to mm-hmm. vote for you, and you're targeting 66 million people mm-hmm. in 66 million different ways, mm-hmm. you're never going to say or twist the language in such a way that it appeals to me, but not necessarily to you.
Oh, well, look, there are an infinite number of ways to describe a policy. You know, English is a very rich language. There are lots of words we can use to describe the same policy, and we will certainly test that. There are lots of policies that the president supports, and lots of policies that the president opposes. We choose which of those to talk about, and we choose how to talk about them. But we're not going to test things that aren't true, because we would never say them. Mm.
One of the things that some of your colleagues who are trying to do this in the business world say that the reason they're doing this in the business world is it keeps them sharp, it helps them develop ongoing techniques and further refine the techniques they've already been using, so that when the next presidential campaign rolls around, they'll be ready for that and they'll be sharper for it. Can we anticipate then that every succeeding campaign is going to make a greater use of this kind of process and you'll be better at it?
I think that's true. We've seen every year, every 2 years, every 4 years, we've seen a huge leap forward in terms of the accuracy of our predictive models, the data we collect, and the ambit of what we do. And I think that is going to continue in elections to come.
How many of the techniques that you used and the methods that you used, and I'm not sure of the right word to use there, but how many of the things that you did in the course of winning in 2008 and 2012 had been used prior to their use in political campaigns in business marketing?
So some of them have been used. These have grown up at the same time. The interest in big data and analytics in the political space and in the corporate space has grown at the same time, partly because of the increasing availability of data, particularly online data, but also because of the greater computing capacity and the building of skills. And so some of what we did in politics was inspired by what was going on in the corporate sector. And now because we made such a big leap forward in certain areas in this presidential campaign, we're bringing that back to the corporate sector. So there's a lot of constant back and forth learning from one to the other.
You have all this vast amount of data, free data from the states about voting records mm-hmm. and how people voted, which was not only not available to somebody selling a car, but it's not necessary to sell a car. What other avenues do you use in the business world to replicate what you get from voting records that would help businesses position and then sell their product?
Sure. Well, first of all, actually, many of those folks who are selling cars do have access to that data and do use that data.
Why? Why would it be useful to them?
It tends to be less useful to them, but some of the information is useful. I mean, it includes people's address, their data.
Democrats buy a Chevrolet and Republicans
exactly.
buy a Lexus.
Exactly. There's some of that, but at the very least, you can get people's name, address, age, and so that information can be used by them. But on the commercial side, folks have to use different sets of data, and so there's data available about people's purchase behavior, for example, right. that has been collected by companies, by these big data companies, and is sold to other companies.
Yes, and they have use of something that you made use of, and that is social media. You made mm-hmm. extensive use of social media, particularly Facebook. And businesses do this because if you like something, something on Facebook, they know it. You compiled a list of people who signed into the campaign through Facebook, and when they did that, they were met with a prompt asking to grant the campaign permission to scan their Facebook friends lists, photos, and other personal information. And if they granted you that permission, you had access then to millions of names and faces to match against lists of persuadable voters and donors and things like that. I don't know how you make those matches, but I'm curious if this same thing is happening when you like a company. That is what happens when you like a company. They know it and they use it. They mine it.
They can. They absolutely can. They have the same opportunity that that we had to do that. And that is something that a lot of companies are very interested in.
Is Facebook a flash in the pan? Is it going to be continually valuable going down the road, or was that its zenith in 2012 and now we're seeing a decline?
I don't know the answer to that. I think that that space is changing so quickly,
right.
The online space. We've seen the leading firms in that industry, the leading online retailers, the leading browsers, the leading social websites, years ago, it was Friendster or MySpace.
Right.
And so there will be something that comes after Facebook. I don't know when that will happen.
We have about 30 seconds, and I've gotten several emails from people who want to know predictions for 2016, and particularly Hillary. What are the chances she could win in 2016?
Well, I don't have any inside information or any insight into her personal decision-making process. I certainly hope that she runs. I think she'd be a fantastic candidate, and I think she would have an excellent chance of winning.
Are we, the data mind, winners or losers in all of this? Quickly.
I think that to a certain extent, it's very helpful to people to get the right kinds of...
And let me stop you there. Andrew Claster, Deputy Chief Analytics Officer.